Hey guys, it's Brandon from the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. At MacroOps, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm Data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, MARHELM.com to get your discount today. This episode of ValueHive is brought to you by Tegas. If you enjoy listening to ValueHive, you'll love the Tegas product. Tegas has the world's largest collection of instantly available expert interviews on all the public and private companies that you care about. All you have to do is log in. So if you're tired of high cost and time-consuming expert research calls, give Tegas a try and see for yourself why many of the most trusted and well-respected hedge funds, mutual funds, family offices, allocators, and VCs rely on Tegas to scale their expert research and to get the critical information they need faster than ever. You can sign up for a free trial at tegas.co/valuehive. That's tegas.co/valuehive. And as a personal anecdote, I use Tegas literally every single day. It's the first resource I use when I start researching a new investment, and it's one of the last things I do before I finish up rounding out my research, and I know you'll love it as much as I do. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Okay, Calvin Froge, I tweeted that I was getting you on the podcast, and I think it was one of the most liked podcast guest announcements that I've had on my Twitter to date. A lot of that has to do with how well Petrobras has done I'm sure of it. And you have undoubtedly taken a much deserved victory lap on Twitter with how right you've been on that. And we'll get into how you think there's still, you know, a lot of meat maybe left on that bone there. So for those that don't know you, though, this is our first time really, really interacting. Who is Calvin Froge, and how'd you get started investing?
So I'm from a small town in Kentucky. I grew up in the country. I spent most of my childhood like hunting and fishing and, you know, doing redneck type stuff. So, you know, that's my background. Okay. But I also was into books and computers. My mom got me a computer when I was like five. So I was doing DOS programming, you know, when I was really young, installing games, using text editors. So I got on a computer and my parents put a bunch of books in the house. Yeah, I was reading everything. You know, I remember when I started Accelerated Reader in elementary school, you know, I'd read like hundreds of books a year, and maybe the person after me read 10, right? So I was just always, you know, like super into kind of information and history and learning. You know, I liked commodity stuff even when I was a kid. You know, I was interested in precious metals and, you know, in oil and machines. My dad ran a machine shop. He built, you know, kind of industrial automation equipment. So I was, you know, kind of exposed to that trade at a very early age. I didn't finish high school. I didn't go to college. I've never had a 9-to-5 job. I've always just kind of done my own thing. So obviously, when you're doing your own thing, investing is second nature, right? It's just something that you have to do. You know, whether it's investing in your own business or investing in somebody else's business. You know, I've had a lot of businesses. I've tried a lot of different things. It's just, you know, always something that's just kind of been part of my life, right?
That's incredible. You know, not graduating high school, not going to college and building something for yourself and trying different things. Somehow you made your way into Latin America and, you know, found a love for Latin American stocks and equities and oil and gas. What were you doing before that, though? So you said you didn't graduate high school. Walk me through the different odds and ends, maybe different business ventures you had, and if there are any lessons you took that now allow you to become a better investor today.
Okay, well, I'm not going to go through every single failed minor business idea that I ever, you know, ventured. But long story short, I've been doing software for about 20 years in some capacity. Mm-hmm. I was selling websites in the bathroom when I was 14 in high school. I was skipping class and in the bathroom, and, you know, somebody flushes the toilet, or the principal comes on a loudspeaker and it's like, "I'm sorry, I lost you there for a second." Right. So, you know, I was just kind of always doing some kind of business, and it was usually a computer related, whether it was, you know, fixing computers for other people or setting up IT networks or doing websites or doing more extensive software stuff. I was living in Ukraine for a while, working with a team there. We were doing apps and websites, etc. And so, you know, how did I come to Latin America? I was living in the US, and I'm trying to do everything that I can to minimize my tax bill. I'm doing all of the things that you're supposed to do, the health savings account, the IRA, and the 401k, and, you know, all the deductions. You know, I've had the same accountant since I was like 16. So, you know, we were like going through the whole, you know, every single possibility, every single stone. And then one day, I'm looking at stuff like movie tax credits and, you know, like environmental conservation credits, and I'm like, this seems hard and complicated. And then I stumbled on the foreign earned income exclusion. And so basically it means if you don't live in the US that you can get a 110, I think it's about 110,000 a year now for a single person, tax deduction on your income that, you know, you don't have to pay to the U.S. And then if you're married, then it doubles. So, you know, you can basically live outside the U.S. It's cheaper anyway. And then you get hundreds of thousands of dollars of tax-free income. So that's basically how I got to Latin America. I you know, looked up a list of countries that had what's called a territorial tax system. And the short version of what a territorial tax system is, it's just a system where they only charge you on income that's derived from within their territory. So for example, I have a hospitality business here. I pay 25% corporate tax to Panama on the income of that hospitality business. For the online stuff that I do, it's not considered business derived in Panama, so I don't need to pay income taxes to the Panamanian government on that income.
Wow, that's pretty sweet. I need to put that in the back pocket.
Yeah, so basically I did a screen on countries that had a territorial tax system. Panama is one of the countries that came up in that list. It's, you know, fairly close to the U.S. It's a 2-hour flight from Miami, 3-hour flight, something like that. And at the time, they had a residency program. You only had to deposit $5,000 in a bank account and then pay like $2,000 in legal fees. And you get residency in this place where you can be. It's, you know, pretty good life here. And you get these huge tax breaks. So, you know, I thought it was better than Puerto Rico. It was better than some other places in Latin America, Paraguay, for instance, Costa Rica, better than Thailand. It just at the time, you know, things have changed a little bit now. It's a little bit more expensive now. You have to buy $200,000 in real estate, I think. But at the time, it was, you know, my first attempt at doing this, and it was just a way to get in with very little risk and upfront capital. So you know, it was the cheapest option, and it had all the characteristics I was looking for. And I found a place that I could tolerate living where the weather was good. So I moved to the mountains. I live at about 4,500 feet. Hmm. The weather is basically kind of like springtime in Kentucky year round, you know.
Wow.
So, I mean, we basically have a dry season and a wet season, but the temperature stays like 55 to 75 pretty much year round.
That's, you're making a convincing case to move to Panama for sure.
Well, a lot of people have done it. I mean, it's got one of the, you know, fastest growing GDPs in the Americas most years. You know, it's definitely a big retirement hub. A lot of Americans, Canadians, Europeans come here and retire. And I'm seeing a lot more young people come here. It's not, you know, exactly like the U.S. In some ways it's better, in some ways it's worse. But overall, I think it's a, you know, very, it's a very functional solution for a lot of young professionals that don't have to be in the place that they are.
Mm-hmm. So you're living in Panama, you're living in Latin America. When did you start investing in Latin America and maybe taking investing in that area seriously from like a portfolio perspective?
Well, the first investment that I made in Latin America was actually in a silver mine that ended up getting nationalized in Guatemala. Well, not nationalized, but that it was, there was some environmental disputes. And so they basically closed the mine, and then the mine, and then so that they basically had the warrant, the shares became warrants, which then converted to shares in the company that ended up buying the mine. So basically what happened was there was a small operator for this mine, and they just didn't have the political capital to be able to operate it. And it ended up eventually getting bought out by a bigger company. I did end up actually making money on that investment, even after like it became untradeable. Wow. And then went to the new owner. At first is, I believe, warrants, and then his shares. It's been a long time, so I don't remember the exact details, but I think that was my first investment in Latin America. And then obviously, you know, buying real estate in Panama, which, you know, I've also operated and also bought and sold.
I forgot to ask you this question early on, but I think it's still early enough to kind of plant the seeds for those that are wondering. You have an unconventional background into investing. Like, there's no doubt about that. How did you get up to speed in these industries? I know you said you were reading from a very early age, you were interested in commodities and metals and all these things, but I want to dig deeper and understand how you learned as much to take that first step to invest in businesses and how that evolution played out. Like, were there books, were there podcasts, were there, you know, websites, or was it just, you know, I went by company until I became comfortable? Like, how did you become?
Yeah, all the above, man. Yeah. I consumed, you know, every piece of information that I could find, you know, talking to other finance people, you know, reading company reports, going through their financial statements. I mean, I never really had a problem with financial statements because, you know, I started doing business on my own when I was, you know, a teenager, right? So I, you know, was used to taxes and what went into that, you know, income statements and cash flow statements and balance sheets. My dad also ran a business. So I was, you know, and it wasn't a super small business, 50 people. So
that's legit.
Definitely was exposed to that from an early age and, you know, involved in it. You know, I worked in my dad's business from when I was like 8 years old, right? Like, I, you know, probably violated some child labor laws at some point. I was 14 years old welding and cutting stuff with an acetylene torch and running mills and lathes and, you know, all that kind of old school dirty stuff where you can lose hands and fingers, but
just normal 8-year-old activities.
Well, I mean, it used to be normal, right?
Yes.
When there were men.
That was fun. Yeah. Yep, man. That's wild. I mean, I don't think you, you know, there's an intangible asset value to your background that I think 9 out of 10 people will never be able to achieve just because they take that traditional route so often because it's so easy.
I mean, I grew up a mile from my grandparents' house. I walked through the woods to go to their house and, you know, would go work at the machine shop after school and on weekends and then go to grandma's house and, you know, eat a baked potato and, you know, watch anime or something and then walk back home through the woods.
Yep.
You know, so, I mean, that was kind of, you know, small town, rural area, not a whole lot of distractions. School was this just kind of like annoying bullshit thing they make you do.
Yep. Yeah. If someone had to, you know, let's say someone walks up to you, they know you're an investor and they ask, you know, hey, like, how would you define your investment philosophy today? What would you say?
Buy cheap and pray.
You know who else says that is Ina on Twitter. I don't know her handle, but she's a deep value investor.
Yeah, I like her.
That's her mantra.
No, it really is a kind of a good general philosophy because look, you're not going to get it right every time, okay? And most of the time, when something screws you, it's not going to be the stuff that you thought about. It's going to be the stuff that comes out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy cheap, you can get lucky. Okay. If you pay to, you know, my dad used to tell me growing up, you know, you make your money when you buy, you know?
Yep. No, it's a good thesis. I just wish one day I would see an investor letter from a value-based hedge fund that says, because every hedge fund letter has the same mantra, like our investment strategy is to buy companies that trade less than they're worth, that are good businesses. It's like, I just want one sentence, like I buy cheap and I pray it works.
Yeah, no, I don't just kind of randomly, you know, buy anything that has like a low PE ratio.
Of course.
Right. I try to look at kind of the multi-year business cycle, right? Because a lot of times, especially with commodity businesses, people say, well, they look cheapest at the top, right? And what that means is that, you know, their revenues peak, their trailing revenue, trailing fee looks really cheap, but actually, you know, you're paying a lot more for the assets. So, you know, you do need to look at, I think, you know, now we've got like 0-day calls, we've got quarterly earnings calls, we've got high frequency data. You know, there used to just be like annual reports, right? And annual dividends. People thought on longer time scales. People, you know, thought about full business cycles. Now everybody's terrified of what's going to happen, not just like next month, but next week and tomorrow morning. You know, people treat trading like it's some kind of 9-to-5 job and they have to make money every single day. It's not like that. You know, you got to think at least medium term to long term. You know, don't use, if you use leverage, I usually don't use too much leverage right now. I'm not using any at all. But if you're going to use leverage, then, you know, think about the risk you're taking. I don't use a whole lot of options, right? Because kind of short term things can happen that scare you or screw you. And it prevents you from seeing where things are going long term. Like, for example, tankers was kind of the way that I guess I started gaining some notoriety in, you know, the online investment circles. And I got into tankers because I knew it was cyclical. I knew they were cheap. I knew the fundamentals were improving around the order book. And I knew that they were about to have these big environmental regulations coming in that were going to kind of disrupt the normal shipping operations. And usually disruption and chaos are really good for shipping, right? So that's kind of how I got into tankers. And then over the next 6 months of going into that investment, it was kind of a roller coaster. It was going really well. Their rates were, you know, super high. I bought the stocks really cheap. You know, some of them I got a double or triple in, you know, a few months, and then COVID happened, and so tankers started pricing that in before everything else did. And a lot of people got scared. They got out of the trade. They never went back. But the fundamentals hadn't changed, right? The order book hadn't changed. The fleet to order book ratio hadn't changed. The age of the fleet, you know, they just gotten old, right? So I stayed in the trade. There was a, you know, contango spike. Basically the Russia and Saudi Arabia had a price war. They both flooded the market with oil. Tanker rates went ballistic, and I stayed through that. I did take some profits at the top, selling calls, etc. And then after contango, they cut OPEC cut production, and the U.S. you know, a lot of U.S. producers cut production as well. And so then the tanker rates crashed, and by September or October of that year, everybody had just completely lost hope. It was like outright despair. The management teams, you know, they were calling them frauds and, you know, liars and, you know, capital destroyers and all this stuff. And that was when I launched my tankerdata.com website. And I stayed in the trade and I added a lot. I bought a lot of stock at prices that, you know, I thought were absolutely crazy. I mean, companies that were trading, you know, around their scrap value. And then, you know, you buy cheap, you can wait for something good to happen. You know, if you buy cheap, something good is more likely to happen. You know, I think it was Cuppy that said that, you know, more money is made in investing when a shitty situation turns into a slightly less shitty situation than anything else. So that was kind of what happened with tankers. So, you know, 2021, things got a little bit better. You know, travel started picking back up, oil demand started picking back up, and the tankers started appreciating. Mm-hmm. And over the summer, you know, I said, hey guys, you know, look, maybe the socks have outrun the fundamentals a little bit. I took some off the table. And then after the Q3 results came out in 21, so the stocks kind of sold off again because, again, they'd outrun their fundamentals. And then they, you know, the U.S. announced they were going to do these big SPR releases. And I was like, okay, guys, get back in heavy. You know, the U.S. is going to flood the market with oil. And, you know, everybody, again, was in that kind of like, you know, despairing, pessimistic state by that time. Nobody wanted to be long tankers. So, you know, a lot of times I was like the only guy that was out there pounding the table, you know, buy now. And so then, my group, we got super heavy into tankers again at when the U.S. announced the SPR releases. And then in February, the Ukraine war happened. So when that happened, it, you know, shifted the trade routes. You had all of a sudden Russian oil going to China and India. You had Russian diesel going to much further places, East Africa, West Africa. You had, you know, Russian oil going to India and then India refining it and sending diesel to Europe. And, you know, it just kind of made the trade lanes a lot longer, caused a lot of chaos. At the time, you know, I was like super, super heavy in tankers. A lot of my group was too. So we all did really well last year. I mean, you know, the Ukraine war is terrible. Okay. Like I'm really, you know, it's really sad what's happened. But, you know, as investors, our job is not to have emotional viewpoints about events. It's to profit from events, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, if you buy cheap, you know, you wait around for a catalyst, then you make money.
When you were looking at those tanker stocks, and we can even, you know, look at some of them today, because I think some tankers and some shipping companies are actually, you know, shaping up, perking up a little bit. Like I know Danos, DAC,
well, that's containers.
Right.
And I told people to short containers at the top and containers got killed.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. Danos got crushed
because people ignored the economic cycle and they ignored the order book. The order book got massive. And you know, the reason containers went crazy was because all these governments were printing money, you know, COVID stimulus, you know, they were giving everybody, you know, cash, and people were spending that cash on ship from China.
Yes.
Right. And that ship from China comes on ships. Right. So that's why containers went crazy. And then containers, you know, then the business cycle changed, interest rates started going up, you know, the stimulus started going away and fewer ships got sent, you know, retailers had enough inventory,
yep,
et cetera. So, you know, my data service that I have now, that's part kind of what we help people do, is understand these business cycles with a focus on maritime trade, because most global trade is seaborne, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like my dad's company did a lot of stuff for commodity exporters in the U.S. that, you know, would send out raw materials, lumber, et cetera, and that would go on ships. You know, a lot of the consumer products, you know, you go into Walmart, most of that comes in on a ship, you know, a container from China, you know, all the oil, all the refined products, kind of within the U.S., a lot of it goes pipeline or rail, but, you know, globally, almost all of it's seaborne, right? So, you know, people, I think maritime has traditionally been a sector that people have really overlooked. Yep. They don't think about it, right? Because most people don't live in port cities and watch ships coming in and out all day. You know, it started when I moved to Panama and saw the canal and saw these ships coming and going. It kind of got me a lot more interested in the maritime space because I just realized how important it was.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember, and I live in Annapolis near the Chesapeake Bay, and I think it was a few years ago, and obviously these things have gone in and out of the bay like thousands and thousands of times, but I never appreciated it. Like you said, it was just like this thing that happened in the, you know, in the simulation that's life, that I just thought was like, you know, this non-playable character in the background. But
yeah, that's money floating around, man.
Exactly. And so when I was on a fishing trip in like 2017 or 2018, and we were, you know, we were in this like small Boston whaler, and we were, you know, boating by next to this huge, I think it was an Everbridge tanker, or some tanker name,
maybe Evergreen.
That's what it was. Yep. Evergreen tanker. And the thing was massive. And like, when you're right next to it, you just look up and you're like, oh my gosh, like these things are behemoths of not only just steel, but capital, manpower, oil, like, and you've got thousands of these going across the world every single day. And you don't appreciate it, right? Like, I didn't fully appreciate it until I would say that moment. I'm like, man, like, that's amazing. Like, it really is.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. That's why I'm in the field that I am. You know, that's why I'm doing maritime data. I mean, you know, ships are at the core of the global commodities trade.
And so when
the global commodities trade, in my opinion, you know, like, commodities are the only part of the economy that really, really matters, right? Hmm. Everything else is a derivative.
Yeah.
You know, everything else, you know, the finished products, et cetera, you know, none of it happens without those commodities. You know, people talk about, you know, reducing emissions and energy transition. Again, none of that happens without commodities. You know, none of your consumer products, you know, none of your television that's, you know, broadcast on, you know, cross subsea cables that are, you know, full of metals, right? You need commodities for all of that.
Yeah. And I think what it boils down to is there's that base of the pyramid of the hierarchy of needs that just gets completely forgotten about because we're at the top of the pyramid working on like these really small incremental improvements to our lives. Like we want a bed with Wi-Fi so it can be colder in the summer, but we completely forget about these base commodities that make every single other part of that hierarchy of needs pyramid functional.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you're looking at like, I want to wrap up tankers before we dive into Petrobras, but when you look at these tankers, you said in the beginning, you said, you know, hey, I was looking at these things. They were really cheap. I was buying them really cheap. You mentioned scrap value. When you go to analyze these stocks, and let's take, you know, like a full business cycle return perspective, how do you source these ideas? And then how do you decide like, okay, between tanker one or tanker two, I'm going with this one for XYZ. Maybe it's cheaper. And then if it's cheaper, how do you define cheapness?
Okay. So when I was a kid, my dad, one of the things he would do if he had some extra money was if steel was cheap, he'd buy steel, right? Because he knew he was going to have to use it sooner or later.
Yep.
So if you think about, you know, what are shipping companies? What's the value? Well, the value is mostly steel. Okay. So I wrote an article a couple of years ago that was, you know, basically steel inflation and shipping. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the argument was that steel's historically cheap. Steel's going to get a lot more expensive. Ships are mostly steel. Buy ships.
I mean, that's a simple back of the envelope. That's three sentences. I mean, that's literally three sentences right there.
That's all it takes, man. People make it too complicated. You know, so, but beyond that, you know, picking which companies, then, you know, that's a lot of what my service does is dig into equities. We study about 50 maritime equities. You know, we look at dividend policies, we look at buybacks, you know, so shareholder return policies, you know, kind of fleet profile, capital structure. You know, there's definitely dragons with some companies, you know, some of the Greek shipping companies, you know, you'll get your ass handed to you quick. You need to know sort of what to look out for, which, you know, there are some really good companies out there that are kind of sponsors of more than one shipping company, like BW Group. I've invested in basically three different companies that they are the majority shareholder of. You know, Oaktree is another a fund that is big in several companies. So you know, you kind of learn what the markers of quality are. And I also like stuff that pays out the return, right?
Yeah.
I want that big yield. I want that big dividend. I want the capital returned to me as a shareholder. I don't want it to sit on the balance sheet. you know, buybacks, I don't hate either. I don't think I like buybacks as much as dividends, especially if the dividends are continuous, you know, because sometimes you can get kind of, you know, bad market cycle and buybacks don't really matter, or you know, maybe the stock is too expensive and the company shouldn't be buying back their stock. They should be returning, you know, capital to shareholders, because buybacks are an investment by the company implicitly, right? If the company's making that investment, then they should know what the return that they're getting on that investment is. So for example, in the case of, you know, Petrobras, you know, I look at a stock that's trading at 2x earnings, a little less trailing earnings, and paying out, you know, 30% to 40%. And the inflation, the interest rate in Brazil is just under 14%. So, you know, their project, I think their return on capital employed, you know, is usually mid-teens to, you know, it's somewhere like kind of those lower double digits. So the equity itself is one of the highest possible returns that they could make. So yeah, in that case, the company, which they announced they're going to do buybacks, you know, buying shares is a really good use of capital. Yep. But if the share is expensive, give me dividends.
Yep. And that's a great segue into Petrobras. So like I said at the beginning, you nailed this trade so far. And you know, the yield, I remember looking at Petrobras, and this name is one that I've kicked myself. And I don't know how much of that's hindsight bias, where, you know, I saw the yield, I saw the I think I looked at it at like when it was 9, I think it got to sub 9 at one point, like earlier on in this year, late 2022. And I didn't pull the trigger because anytime I would, you know, pitch this idea to other oil and gas investors, they would say, oh, like I would never touch that stock, like political risk too high, geopolitical risk way too high. Like this, yeah. like they're going to freeze the dividend. You're not going to get your dividend, blah, blah, blah. And now we've seen them not only pay dividends, but increase production and really do everything that you would want an oil and gas company to do, they are doing. And I want you to walk me through how you found the idea, and then how you went about due diligence, with an emphasis on understanding and discounting geopolitical risk.
Yeah. So, the first time that I bought into Petrobras was in 2021 at $7 and change. And so I traded in and out of it some. I didn't know a whole lot about it at the time. I mean, I had seen it before. I was familiar with it. You know, I've done other oil investments in the past, and I was familiar with, you know, the players in the space. And obviously with tankers, Petrobras is a name that I see a lot because they charter a lot of tankers. You know, it got sold off in 2021 because the president of Brazil at the time appointed a CEO of the company who was a general. And I'm like, okay, well, this is a company that was literally started by the Brazilian military. So how crazy is it that a general would run a country, or would run a company started by the Brazilian military?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it just didn't seem like the craziest leap. So, you know, I just kind of, you know, discounted that political risk initially, just because it just didn't seem like a very crazy situation to me.
Yep.
And the more that I got into it, you know, the more I kept following it, and I saw that even though Bolsonaro, the previous president, changed the CEO 5 times, nothing ever changed with the company. So that tells you that either the president doesn't really have any power, or that it's just kind of like kabuki theater. You know, the president needs to be like, oh yeah, I'm on the side of the people, where we want, you know, free gas for everybody. But then, you know, the conversations being had in the background are like, you know, look, you know, we need to support a currency, we need a stable budget, you know, we need a fiscal surplus, et cetera. Right, yeah. Which is part of why the real has performed really well in the last couple of years, is because they you know, they have employed fiscal discipline, and there's been a commodity surge. So it sold off during COVID. It's appreciated a lot since. A lot of people other than me who are really smart, are, and you know, seasoned investors, are really bullish on on Brazil and Brazil's currency. Some people are still really bullish on commodities. Some people think that a recession is going to wipe commodities out. I've got a kind of mixed feelings about that, but you know, Petrobras seemed to me that it was cheap enough and their production cost was low enough that, yeah, you might lose some money if oil crashes. That's probably the biggest risk to the thesis. It's probably not political risk, probably isn't the biggest risk. I mean, you know, it's been a public company, I think, for like, you know, for decades for sure. I want to say it has been publicly traded in some way for like 70 years.
Wow.
Okay, so it's definitely got a long history, right? I mean, it's, and somebody could say, okay, well, PDVSA and Venezuela had a long history too. And yeah, but I think that, you know, the stuff like Venezuela, that is kind of more of the exception, not the rule. And people, you know, it's sort of recency bias, kind of making people think that those sorts of things happen more frequently than they actually do. I mean, even Argentina, which is a total basket case and which has had, you know, like expropriation debates and issues in the past. I mean, even those guys are trying to run the company at a profit and, you know, buying back shares because they were too cheap. So, I mean, that's even Argentina, which has like a 97% inflation rate. Right. Yeah. Like every problem that you could possibly have, you know, YPF still, you know, is still a profitable enterprise. I mean, these, you know, these state companies, these state monopolies, which, you know, Warren Buffett has actually invested in state monopolies before. I mean, you know, they're monopolies. They make a lot of money.
Yeah. Monopolies are, you know, arguably the best business you could ever own. That's kind of the quintessential.
So I'm not saying there are no risks. I'm not saying that, you know, that there's not going to be subsidies. I'm not saying that there's not going to be higher taxes, but, you know, Harbour Energy in the UK had like a 99% drop in profit, and it's a private operator. And it had like a 99% drop in profit because of UK windfall taxes. Vermilion Energy, which was domiciled in Ireland, I believe, they got hit with an 85% windfall tax. They're a private company, right? Exxon just had a bunch of assets in Africa nationalized, okay? So people talk, you know, like when somebody talks to me about nationalization risk for Petrobras, that I immediately know that this person just does not know what they're talking about at all. Hmm. Petrobras is already nationalized, right? Saudi Aramco is already nationalized. They are national companies. You could nationalize them more, but what would be the incentive for that? You know, if the you know, these companies in the lean times are reliant on international capital markets to fund their bonds. If they go around acting like, you know, crazy dictators and, you know, just being like, oh yeah, you know, I'm just going to take these shares, I'm just not going to pay back these bonds, then they're going to get shunned by the international community. They're not going to be able to raise capital at good rates, right? They're going to be pariahs. Their funding costs are going to be through the roof. There's basically zero incentive that I can see for these companies to just take away private shareholders, you know, stakes in these things. I see a lot more nationalization risk in private company, in, you know, privately owned companies that maybe may or may not be publicly traded, that are operating in not just developing market jurisdictions, but also in developed market jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. I mean, what was this windfall tax in the UK? That was a nationalization of profits, right?
Yep.
Isn't the UK supposed to be developed market capitalist, right? Supposed to be.
Yep.
Okay. But, you know, people talk about nationalization risk. You know, the United States has nationalized energy companies before. It has nationalized railroads before. This has happened in virtually every single jurisdiction on the planet. But what it has, you know, you can't nationalize something that's already nationalized.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you know, the other thing too, and you brought up the UK, you brought up the US, but another one that's, you know, that I think you have to discount is investing in anything in Canada and just wondering what the Canadian government would ever do to some of these energy plays. Like, there's nothing stopping Canadian governments from having these massive windfall taxes or even trying to nationalize some of their stuff.
Well, I don't follow Canada as closely as some people do, but I have seen chatter and people say, oh, you know, they won't do that because Alberta and Saskatchewan will secede. They'll join the U.S. I mean, I don't know. I don't think the risk zero, right? I think in general, you know, the risks are, you know, the harder the times, the more desperate the measures, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No country has a strong incentive to go screw things up when things are okay. You know, they don't have a incentive to go out and take private property when everybody's prosperous. It's when things get bad that these things are more likely.
This brings me to a question that I've been wrestling with in my head as I look at PBR. You know, I still haven't bought it. You know, I would actually like to get your thoughts on where you think it trades from here over the next, you know, 12 to 18 months. But at what price is something cheap enough where you can say, you know what, this thing is so cheap where I think almost every single risk is priced in? Like, I mean, is it 2x earnings? Is it half replacement costs? Like, you know, and does that change?
Yeah, it probably depends on the company. It depends on the sector.
Yeah.
I would pay more for petrol. Like, you know, think about the life of the assets, right? I think that's a good thing to ask when you're asking how many, you know, what kind of earnings multiple should I put on it? I think with shipping, you're most likely to make money if you buy when the assets are cheap. With these commodity companies, it's pretty hard to argue that Petrobras is expensive or not cheap on pretty much any metric or historically. I think it is probably cheap enough that you can't go wrong. I mean, the yield is so high. Just if you just have a 4-year time scale, and you're looking at the yield and options income, you're going to make your money back plus some profit pretty much for sure, I think. Or at least that's my, you know, that's my justification. Like, you know, I went into this year thinking it could be tough for commodities. It could be tough for the market in general. And so I wanted to go with really defensive, safe plays. So I picked stuff that I thought was already, you know, had bad sentiment or was, you know, pretty cheap and had a really high yield. I didn't invest in anything at the beginning of this year. I picked five investments, and I didn't invest in, I invested in one thing that wouldn't have a yield this year, but could have a yield in the future. The others, I think the lowest yield on any of them was about 25%. So I picked four names that had I expected a 25 to 50% yield for this year.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a ton of margin of safety that insulates you from a lot of risk. And
if the company doesn't disappear, if the listing doesn't disappear, you wait 3-4 years, you make money.
Yep. One of those names, I believe, was Echo Petrol. Ticker symbols EC. Walk me through that thesis. I mean, on the surface, again, I haven't dug into it. On the surface, it sounds similar to Petrobras, where it's a high yielding play, high quality asset that's been around for a long time. And it just so happens, I think the yield is like 25%, 25 or 30 last time I checked.
Yeah, it was 25% at the beginning of the year. There was going to be three dividends. They've paid one of them already. So, you know, the shares at $9 and change. You've got another, 2 $0.85 dividends coming up. And then on the last earnings call, the CFO was talking about the possibility of some extraordinary dividends too. It seems to me that it would probably be about another 50 cents possible. The stock's $9. You could probably get another $2 in dividends. this year, I already got 85 cents or 84 cents, so far this year. But basically, they elected a leftist president. He said he wanted to stop doing fossil fuels. He's got, super ambitious dreams on social programs. He's a former communist guerrilla.
Hmm.
Okay. Or Marxist guerrilla, actually, I think. So, he's definitely as scary as it gets, as far as his political profile. And so the EC stock sold off about 50%. And, so I started getting interested in it because it sold off. And then after I started digging in, I looked at the, they wanted tax reform on, so they increased the taxes, for example, on oil and gas companies. They took away royalty deductibility so yep. that some tax deductions went away. And the market thought that those factors were going to be much more significant than they ended up being in reality.
Hmm. So, what do you mean by that? Like factors as in just affecting the share price or sentiment?
Well, I think it was an analyst from Citi that his estimate on the actual tangible impact on the bottom line was 4 or 5 times larger than the actual impact.
Wow.
So, the market basically thought that all profitability and cash flow is going to disappear. I mean, there are plenty of war with Ecopetrol for sure. Another one is they had this fuel subsidy that the previous right-wing capitalist president did. And this new left-wing communist president has been unwinding this fuel subsidy, raising fuel prices every month since October or November. Okay. So I just let's back up and think about that. The right-wing guy put in all the subsidies and ran up a debt between the country and the company. The left-wing guy is in favor of eliminating that debt.
It's like an episode of Punk'd or something.
Yeah. So anyway, instead of the Colombian government is an 88.5% shareholder of Ecopetrol. Okay. And instead of the Colombian government receiving their 88.5% dividend, that 88.5% of the dividend is reducing the debt owed to the company by the country, which were the fuel subsidies from the previous government.
Got it. So eventually, I guess is the thesis that once they pay off that debt and those and they pay down those subsidies, that will just go right back to dividends.
So the entire 2022 balance of the fuel subsidy is supposed to be paid off this year. And okay. then the debt is supposed to stop growing this year because they're going to continue raising fuel prices. I think they're raising it like 400 pesos a month or something.
Mm-hmm.
I know
when we discussed shipping valuations, and one of the ways that you decided on what was cheap is, the scrap value and the steel value and buying it, below maybe what its replacement cost is worth. When you look at valuing something like a Petrobras or an Ecopetrol, how do you go and decide on value? Because I know you can just look optically and say, okay, it's 2x earnings, but are there any metrics? For instance, like I know a popular one is, the price of a barrel of oil per day production. So for instance, like you'll see companies, I think it was Vital Energy just, bought some Permian asset and they paid like, I want to say it was like $30,000 per barrel of oil per day production. Is that kind of how you also value it, or is it a combination of that?
And I've done some posts on my blog.
Okay.
Where I go through some different companies and I valued them. Basically this is the price per 1,000 barrels of energy per day. This is the price for sales, for reserves, EV over EBITDA, debt over EBITDA. This is the yield, price per earning. So I look at a lot of different metrics. And when I look at all those metrics, YPF was the cheapest on a few of them. but Petrobras was the cheapest on virtually all of them.
Yeah. Yep. That makes sense.
I mean, you know, just like globally. Actually, Equinor in Norway is also pretty cheap on a lot of
metrics. I've looked at Equinor. That is, and so for those that are listening, the ticker symbol is EQNR. I think it trades, what is it? Is it just on the Oslo exchange or is it anywhere?
No, it's got an ADR.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's another one I've looked at. But so when you go to screen these ideas, like let's say, you know, whether it's Petrobras or Ecopetrol, how do you source these things? Like is it just your screening by absolute cheapness? Is it, you know, you just have this Rolodex because you know shipping so well where you're like, all right, I know all of these partners and let me just look there first.
Yeah, I think most of these ideas come from kind of the extended shipping commodities universe. You know, either names that I've seen in the past. You know, I do run screeners every once in a while, and I will screen for different types of companies. Like, for example, you know, I don't just do shipping commodities. Like, for example, last year, I picked a U.S. defense contractor that it was an old company. They canceled their dividend, so the company sold off in the dividend cancellation. It was trading a pretty big discount to the replacement value of their assets. So, you know, I mean, this is a small company, so it's easy. I basically looked at, you know, Zillow and valued their land, valued their facility.
Yep.
Looked into, you know, replacement costs per square foot on the manufacturing, right? And looked at their historical earnings. It wasn't super, super cheap. On their historical earnings, but it did look cheap as far as, you know, discount to assets. They didn't have any debt. It was a debt-free company, so I thought there was a good, you know, if they start making money, they don't need to pay off debt, so the, you know, it has to go to the dividend, right? So I think the dividend is going to get reinstated. So my thesis was basically, okay, well, the employee ESOP for the company bought shares at way above the current price. The ESOP, you know, wants to be in the money on those shares. So, they've got a strong incentive to bring back the dividend, do whatever they can to build value. And you've got a big war going on, and the U.S. is like crazy short on production capacity for weapons. These guys did avionics for submarines and airplanes and stuff. So that was about a double, a little bit less than a double in a year. And you know, that was a tiny company, sub 20 million market cap, you know, hardly any trading volume. I mean, some days I would literally be the only person that bought shares, you know, but it worked out because, I valued it. Another one that, wasn't like a huge home run or anything, but I got my dad and some friends into this company that were also in like a lot of NASDAQ names and stuff in 2021, 2022, was Chicago Rivet and Machine. And so, you know, that we bought in 2021, and it pretty much, you know, just kind of like slow and steady, had a lot of spikes up to $30 or so, you know, some chances to sell it. And it was paying like a healthy yield, like 4%, which, you know, if it's between, you know, a safer name with a low yield and, no debt and assets that are worth more than the trading price, or, you know, some like, you know, Teladoc or something, right? With, you know, all of those high growth kind of expensive stocks all did really poorly when inflation started picking up. All of the, you know, kind of tangible assets, you know, real world value stuff did well.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
So I ran screeners to find debt-free companies that had positive earnings. I run screeners to find stuff that's, I feel like it's super levered. For example, that's kind of how I got into Braskem. It just kept coming up in a lot of screens as far as, you know, having the ability to earn very large profits versus having a very small market cap. also looking at, you know, like debt versus market cap and enterprise value versus market cap. I mean, it's basically the same thing. But, you know, like, look, you know, those are the kinds of things that you look at to find investments that potentially have torque, that have a lot of leverage, right?
Yep.
You know, big debt, small market cap, tons of leverage.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a few names on my watch list, and I own a couple that have a ton of torque. But I like what you said earlier, where because of the knowledge you have in shipping and tankers, you can build, you know, I think, there's a great investor that I talked to a bunch, and he's big on building mosaics. And so basically taking information and knowledge that you've learned in one space and using it to inform decisions in another space, or use it to grow into another space. And I just think that's very important, where, like, you've got this information in shipping and you can use that to generate new ideas in agriculture, commodities, in energy and oil, in precious metals, or, you know, platinum or copper, or things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, if you study maritime shipping, tankers, you've got insight into oil producers, oil production, refined fuels. You know, I also did really well on refineries. I was long three refining names in the Ukraine war run-up. PBF Energy, I think it's, I don't know, I'm not sure where it is today, but I bought a lot of PBF Energy at $5 a share. It's at $35 a share now. Now, I've sold it since then. But even now, at $35 a share, it's at 1.4 times earnings, right? You know, like, when I was buying this at $5 a share, people are like, oh, the debt, they're going to go bankrupt. COVID, all the refineries are going to go bankrupt. And I'm thinking, look, oil demand's going to come back. You've got, like, you know, more than 5%. I think at one point it was almost 10% of U.S. refining capacity got shut down. These guys own 5% of refining capacity. Yeah, they have a lot of debt, but they've also got $2 billion in cash, and none of their debt matures in, like, the next 5 years.
Yep.
You can't go bankrupt if you don't have maturities.
Yeah, that's very important.
You can literally just turn off everything and wait. You can't go bankrupt if you don't have maturities. So I bought a lot of that. And you know, I knew the only reason I knew about it was because of my shipping investments, right? I knew that because of the fuels, shipping fuels, I knew about IMO 2020, and I knew that PBF had a high Nelson complexity. Their refineries were able to, you know, take in stuff like fuel oil and then turn it into, you know, basically to desulfurize it to comply with the new environmental regulations. So I knew that their assets were valuable. Vertex Energy was another one I started following. I think the first time I bought any shares, it was at like 50 cents. I started following them because they were going to start producing bunker fuel for ships from used motor oil.
Wow.
You know, when I was a kid, you know, my dad, we would generate heat and electricity from used motor oil. I knew it was valuable. We had a biorefinery in one of my dad's buildings where he was, like, you know, turning, he would go around to all the Chinese restaurants and get all their cooking oil and then turn it into diesel. So I always knew when my dad was pulling up because it, you know, smelled like a Chinese restaurant.
your dad sounds like a pretty smart guy. Like, what's his background?
He studied engineering, civil engineering. And then he worked at the Lincoln Lab at MIT. Wow. And then he worked at aerospace, on some kind of mechanical engineering thing. I want to say rockets. I'm not completely sure, but that's where he met my mom. My mom was working on chemical lasers at aerospace. She went from Hughes Research Lab and, you know, working for Howard Hughes Corporation to aerospace. And then they met working at aerospace. And then my granddad got sick, and my dad moved back to take over his family business.
That is a high IQ relationship right there. Damn.
I got a smart family. I think my brother's probably the smartest of the siblings.
I don't know, man. You bought PBR at $7. You got that to hang up in your wall.
Yeah, but my brother is figuring out how to use machine learning, or he like interned for to use machine learning to find quality issues in a production battery facility.
I'm gonna pretend like I know what that means and just so not like
finding so like finding issues in like machined metals
like on quality a production control line. Almost.
Yeah, so basically like you have stuff going down an assembly line, right? Yep. And you're getting feedback on those materials. I mean, that's my family's an industrial automation background. Yep. So we've done process engineering, materials engineering, like automation, lumber handling, food processing, car parts, aircraft parts, etc. So, but anyway, it was just like an assembly line, and you've got like cameras, and you're trying to get information about what's on the assembly line from these cameras. Actually, I was doing those projects too when I was in my early 20s, and like a kind of commodity automation.
That's fascinating. I'm actually very fascinated by the technology applications in the real asset industries, whether it's commodities, yeah, whether it's metals. Like I saw, and I think this is the second time I've said this on the podcast, so frequent listeners might get annoyed, but I saw this video of a huge earth mover in an open pit mine that was being remote controlled by some dude sitting in a desk like this with basically an Xbox controller. And it's just like stuff like that. It's just like, to me, that's mind blowing. Like that, we can do that. And everybody's obsessed with, AI and these internet apps and Web3, but it's like, man, if you just look to your right, like, and what's going on in this technology in these basic metals and commodities businesses, it's truly incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've spent a lot of time discussing, I would say, from 2021 into 2022. And when I tweeted that I was getting you on the podcast, a lot of people are interested in stuff that you're looking at now and different names. And I know one of them that came up was ASPS, which is, I think, yeah, AltiSource, which is a name that I have kicked around before. I think I've traded in and out of it in 2020, just like a pure kind of technical trade. But what are some things that are interesting you right now that are getting you excited? Whether it's ASPS, whether it's something else. I think BAK, BAK was another one that people wanted to hear about. Just kind of give me your thoughts on what's exciting you right now in markets.
So, the names that we talked about is mostly, I think, what's exciting me.
Yeah.
I'm kind of more focused now on my business, on building up my shipping and commodity kind of data platform. As far as the names that you mentioned, Braskem, it's interesting. They've got a lot of torque, and they've had a lot of bigger companies sniffing around wanting to buy them. So there have been some offers recently. There's been a lot of volatility in the share price based on when those offers are made and whether or not people would think they're going to happen. And then AltiSource, that has been a name that I've got a very low cost basis in. I have traded out of it some, and I'm underwater on it right now. And it's basically just another cyclical foreclosures. They make money if people get foreclosed on. And it is a stock that the last time that they had a good earnings cycle was around the Great Financial Crisis. The stock went from above where it is now, but not very high, to like $175 a share. They put all of their money back. They put all of the profits basically into buybacks. They bought back like 30% of the company. The shares went straight up, and then basically the government accused them of basically shady business practices to foreclose on people. And the guy who started the company, who became a billionaire off of the company, basically, was like, he then lost a lot. The company had a lot of legal problems. again, basically because they made money on foreclosures. So they have a lot of problems in like California. Actually, Kamala Harris, I believe, personally prosecuted them.
Wow.
But the business model, you know, foreclosures were illegal for 2 years, and now they're legal again. So, you know, during COVID, you couldn't do foreclosures. And so, you know, you don't need a big economic crisis to have more foreclosures happen.
Yeah. Yep. No, that makes sense. And I believe it's one of those highly torqued names as well. Like, it's got a ton of debt, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it has a lot of debt relative to its market cap. It's like, I think 250 million or so versus a market cap of 80 something million.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah. So basically people, you know, think that that name's going to go bankrupt, but they've had their maturities extended now a few times, and, or, you know, they pulled some rabbits out of hats basically, right? Yeah. They've had a couple of miracles over the last 2 years that have kept them around. And, you know, now they've had, you know, they sold some stock, they've got some cushion, you know, I mean, it could be a zero for sure. They could, you know, but I don't think it will. I think that, that the business will continue to improve as foreclosures increase. And I think that foreclosures increasing is pretty much a certainty statistically.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't think you need, you know, like people say, oh, well, people have so much equity in their house. I don't think that that matters. I think that just like, you know, long term, the rate at which people get foreclosed on is much higher than it has been for the last couple of years. And again, I think that we will likely trend back towards that rate.
And again, when you're buying cheap enough, like you said, a low enough cost basis, you're giving yourself a low hurdle for what the future needs to look like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a name that I have a whole lot allocated to. It is, you know, a risky name, but I do think that it could work out well.
I want to finish with a couple questions. One on portfolio positioning, and then the last two that I ask every guest. But when you think about buying these names, like, yes, they're cheap. Maybe everything's discounted at 1-2 times earnings. How does that reflect in how much you make that name as a percentage of your portfolio? And maybe how is that philosophy changed over time?
I think in general, smaller companies are more risky than bigger companies, just as a general rule. And, you know, good balance sheets and high yields are less risky than bad balance sheets and anything else, right? So that's, you know, how do I weight things? If there's something that I think that the dividend is secure, and I don't think that there's going to be huge surprises because, you know, just at the scale, I mean, things that are big are hard to change rapidly.
Yeah.
Right. So that's just kind of general philosophy is that the, you know, bigger stuff is going to have fewer problems,
mm-hmm.
fewer potential problems.
No, makes sense. And last couple questions. Where can people go to find out more about you? This is probably a good time to plug your Tanker data service. And for those that are listening that are still with us, there is a discount if you use a code from this podcast, and I think you get 20% off. And you help the podcast. You help Value Hive. So if you wanna go ahead and tell people where to go for that.
Yeah, so my website is marhelm.com. That's the Spanish word for sea. And then helm, which is the steering wheel for a ship.
That's pretty cool.
Okay. So marhelm.com, and you can get 20% off your annual subscription with the coupon code VALUE. So we have recently hired 5 people to improve that service, and we're working on it all day every day. So you know, we've got, you know, a pretty substantial full-time team on it. You can get AIS data, locations of ships, you can get more than 50 shipping equities, and analysis on the value of those companies, interviews with the senior management of those companies. There's a Discord room where a lot of the senior management hangs out, and a lot of shipping investors, commodity funds, other value investors, etc. So there's definitely a lot of different avenues for getting value from that. We also do a weekly report, and the data platform has, you know, tons of different types of information, and we're constantly expanding it, constantly improving it. So it's just going to get better from here. You sign up, you get a grandfathered price. You're never going to pay more. But if you don't sign up, you will definitely pay more later.
And where can people find you on Twitter? That's how we connected.
Just my first and last name.
Got it. Calvin Froge.
Yeah. And or for the company, it's Marhelm Data.
Cool. And I'll include all these links in the show notes. And finally, if you could have dinner with one person from the past or the present, who would it be and why?
Maybe Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius.
I like that answer. I really do.
Yeah. Because that must have been a crazy job. And he wrote a lot of compelling shit. So I just kind of like to pick his brain.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic answer. Calvin, this has been a great conversation, and the entire time we've been talking, there's just kind of one kind of, I guess, a couple words that came into my mind to describe it is just a breath of common sense into how you approach investing. And I really do believe that's because you have come from an unconventional background, and it shows through how you analyze businesses and how you think about trading and investing. That is, like I said, just refreshing. And so I'm very glad we had this conversation. I think people are going to really enjoy this. I know I did. Best of luck to you the rest of the year, and let's definitely stay in touch. And, you know, I'll shoot you any ideas that I think might be up your alley, and I'll be on the lookout for any of yours that come down the pipeline.
Okay. That sounds good to me.
This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally, with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive. This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally, with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.